This is Professor Allen, and welcome to The Quarterbin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue or two from my comic book collection, which I will often select with some degree of randomness. Any couple of books from my comic book collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents each for them. Were the issues worth 25 cents? Were they bargains at 25 cents? Or were they still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 82nd episode of The Quarterbin, we're looking at Vision and Scarlet Witch, issues 3 and 4, a Marvel Comics limited series cover dated January and February 1983. But first, we have a little feedback. Episode 80 was about JLX, the last of our amalgam coverage here on The Quarterbin. And by the way, a week or so after that episode went out, I hit the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, and guess what? I found three more amalgam books. Every time I think I'm out, they keep pulling me back in. I'm not going to cover them here. I'm sticking to that. But probably next month, I'll talk about them on the Comics Reading Journal. During that episode, episode 80, I mentioned David Foster, a new feedbacker, and I wondered if he was also a new listener. Well, the surest way to guarantee that someone writes in is to mention them on the show. Dear Professor, thanks for the shout-out on your latest episode. I am indeed a new subscriber to your podcasts, having found them through your occasional appearances on the Fire and Water shows. Well then, Ryan Daly, Rob Kelly, and I guess Shag, thanks for having me on your shows. I'm enjoying all the shows, and Quarterbin is my favorite. I tend not to comment on the episodes I consume, but if you keep saying my name, I may respond more often. See, I told you, David Foster, that's my secret. David reports that he bought the amalgam books back in the day, all of them. So they don't qualify as Quarterbin purchases for me, but they're still good comics. My kids read them recently, and they really enjoyed them. Some bargain comics I did acquire recently are nearly every issue of Peter David's Fallen Angel series, both for DC and IDW. I got them 3 for $1 at my LCS, which I hope will please you. I'll let you know if I get my money's worth. Your pal in Woodstock, David Foster. As I explained to Shag on that recent episode when, and I can't explain why, I had him on the show, that although 3 for $1 does not technically qualify as Quarterbin for purposes of this show, I heartily approve of any listener nabbing any book at that attractive price point. And on to feedback from last episode, when we covered the first half of this Vision and Scarlet Witch limited series. When I posted the Smoochy Smoochy preview image for that episode, and warned listeners in advance that it was a kissing book, Mark Adams from the excellent Mark's Mess podcast thanked me profusely. I will avert my eyes in a bashful way when I listen. Then, when the episode came out, he shared the Facebook post along with his own content warning. There may be talk about kissing in this. Therefore, one of my co-hosts will not be listening. So, could you listen for her? Her 10-year-old mind cannot cope. However, the episode was quite good. Well, thank you, Mark. Clinton Robinson of the Coffee and Comics blog posted an appropriate gif from The Princess Bride as his reaction to the kissing episode. New Twitter follower Mountain Flower raised an interesting point about the two times now that I've covered Scarlet Witch on this show. Is there a theme in your Scarlet Witch coverage? Because back in Quarterbin 43, the Scarlet Witch was kissing and doing a whole lot more with Hawkeye. Now, I'm not willing to put myself on the psychologist's couch on this one, so I'm just going to go with coincidence as the reason for that, as I replied directly to Mountain Flower, look, I just report what I read. My Facebook buddy Robert Ward commented on my being flummoxed by the organization of this limited series. I was actually taken aback, he says, by your assumption that a miniseries had to have an overall narrative, as I never considered that. Just from bin diving, I know that Marvel released a few minis around this time, and just assume they were intended as finite series to spotlight certain characters. Something like, you always liked Wanda, so here you go, 4 issues where she is a star and not just a background character in an Avengers or X-Men book. Robert's analysis makes a ton of sense, no doubt. I guess I've been brainwashed by the event miniseries concept that has become the norm the last few decades or so. I also heard from Dr. Ange, the proprietor of the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary, and despite how busy his blogging keeps him, he also manages to moonlight as an ER doctor on the side. Ange and I often go back and forth on Twitter, but his response to these issues took him more than 140 characters. So here is a rare email from the good doctor. It was great to hear you talk about the Vision and Scarlet Witch miniseries. While I haven't read it in forever, I did own it as a kid, buying it off the spinner rack. As you say, miniseries were a new idea back then, and the prospect intrigued me enough that I bought many of the ones that came out around this time, even gasp, ones from Marvel. The one thing that stood out to me even then was how gorgeous the art was. I love Leonardi's work, especially on Cloak and Dagger, and Aiken and Garvey seemed to click on inks. I was so enamored of the first issue that I decided to play as a druid in D&D and named my character Sam Haim, pronounced as you did in the episode. So this issue has some personal impact on me as well. As you say, there really isn't one cohesive storyline in the 4 issues of this mini, but I loved it anyways. For me, it was a primer on the 2 characters. It also seemed like Mantlo was going to use this mini to tie off some lingering plot threads. Yes, that's a point that I had brought up as well, and I think that was probably part of the intent. So Ange says, issue 1 introduces us to the heroes and their new environment, and issue 2 ties off the thread with the wizard, Wanda knowing he was no longer her dad, but dealing with why she hadn't told him yet. And without peeking, spoilers, I think issue 3 and 4 deal with Wonder Man being the template for the Vision and Magneto as now being Wanda's dad. In other words, if these two are going to be absent from the Avengers for a while, someone had to deal with the remaining bits of story that were out there. So why not do it in this mini? I loved it. As Robert pointed out, and as Ange is reiterating here, the concept of the limited series as Marvel did this one, it makes a lot of sense. I wouldn't mind returning to this type of model. It's just not the headspace I was in when reading those first 2 issues. And the good doctor continues, as for the characters themselves, I'm more a Scarlet Witch fan than a Vision one. We all are, Ange. We all are. One of the few Marvel books I got back in that decade was the Byrne West Coast Avengers run, which impacted the couple greatly. I would say I'm partial to the way Jim Chung draws her these days, and I hope you have sampled the current James Robinson book, because while there is an underlying long plot, each issue reads like a one and done. I have not done that, Ange, but now I am intrigued. Thank you. I also want to give a shout out to Grant Richter of the Unearthly Visions blog, a blog about The Vision, who retweeted the announcement of that last episode. Noel from Masters of Carpentry did so, as did Siskoid. And Pat from the podcast Long Box Crusade retweeted it, adding the message, "Great episode, just finished listening." Thanks, Pat. The Facebook announcement for that episode was also shared by the Long Box Crusade and We Love Comics. Thanks, guys. The support is always appreciated. All right, a quick break here, and when we come back, it's Vision in Scarlet Witch number 3.
Are you Batman? Oh, you must be, because that's Robin. Hi, Robin.
Yes, Batman and Robin are here. And Tim and Paul are also here to evaluate the Batman TV show that took the nation by storm in 1966.
How in the name of purple wombats do they manage it?
To the Batpoles podcast looks at the writing, the music, the guest stars, how the show fit into its times, and much more. Look for it wherever you get podcasts or at tothebatpoles.libsyn.com. What better way to enjoy the show's 50th anniversary than with To the Bat Poles podcast?
Gosh, yes, Batman. When you put it that way...
Vision and Scarlet Witch number 3 had a cover price of 60 cents, meaning I acquired this book at a not great, but I mean satisfactory, good enough, 58% markdown. The cover by Rick Leonardi shows Vision and Wonder Man lying next to each other on two medical-type tables, while Scarlet Witch is being grabbed from behind by a dude with a scythe. No, not the guy from issue 1 with the scythe, Samhain. This is the Grim Reaper. No, not the metaphysical, supernatural guy, but Eric Williams, who's also Wonder Man's brother. Across the bottom of the page, we read, Blood Brothers, which is the title for the story, which had the same creative team as the issues from last episode. It was written by the great Bill Mantlo, with art by Rick Leonardi, Ian Aiken, and Brian Garvey. We open on a New York subway train. The name of the gentleman with his head in his hands is Simon Williams. He is in a hurry to get where he's going. Then the lights in the car go out, and the train grinds to a halt. The conductor comes by and apologizes for the delay. "Everything okay in here?" he asks. No, everything is not okay. Simon Williams, a.k.a. Wonder Man, has a friend in the hospital, and he can't sit here all day. So he pries the doors open with his bare hands and jumps onto the tracks and single-handedly pulls the train to its destination. Then he arrives at the hospital, where her superhero buddies have come to support Vision and Wanda. Thor, Cap, Iron Man, Hawkeye, She-Hulk, Janet, they're all there. Wanda recounts the events of last issue, which ended in the destruction of Vision's arm. He is in critical condition, in surgery. It's his arm, of course, but he's also in shock and suffering from the android equivalent of massive blood loss, which has put him into a coma. Thor confirms that his alter ego, Donald Blake, would come to the same conclusion. And what Vision needs now is the power of Wonder Man. Janet explains to She-Hulk the connection between the two heroes, how Simon Williams died trying to help them, and how his brain patterns were preserved, and then passed into the Vision's shell of a body, animating it with intelligence. Then years later, Simon Williams himself revived. The drug we thought had killed him just rendered him dormant. Vision has a coma-induced dream, meeting his original self, the synthezoid body into which his mind patterns were placed, the original Human Torch. Back in reality, in the operating room, Simon Williams is prepared for surgery. Thor has to help the surgeon get the needle into Wonder Man to begin the process of retransferring some of his life energies into Vision. Back in the coma world, Vision relives a dreamlike version of his origins and his dealings with his multiple father figures, including Professor Horton and Ultron 5. Wonder Man joins him in the dreamscape, and as they battle Ultron, Vision realizes that it is Wonder Man whose fate was tied to his stronger than any bonds with any father. We have stronger ties than any ties forged had we been real siblings. Looking at Wonder Man is like looking at myself. With their bodies prone during the procedure, Scarlet Witch is left alone in the waiting room to ponder her husband's fate. And she is taken unawares by the Grim Reaper, who makes it into the surgical suite. So this is what keeps the synthezoid alive. All it will take is one swift slice with my razor-edged scythe. And both pretenders to the name Simon Williams, both the Vision and Wonder Man, shall die. And the Grim Reaper shall at last avenge his brother. So the Grim Reaper is Eric Williams, Simon's brother. His issue here is that Simon died. And he should have stayed dead. Both the reanimated Simon and the Vision represent abominations from his perspective, and he couldn't resist the opportunity to finish both of them off at the same time, once and for all. Let the life energy of both pretenders to my brother's persona drain away into the ether until you both lie lifeless. But before he can strike, Vision's physical body animates enough to defend itself. He is unsteady on his feet, but he absorbs attacks and manages to even fight back a bit. Now remember, the procedure was not complete. Vision's not at full strength, and he does not have his arm back. He's very weak. As Grim Reaper prepares to swing his scythe again at the weakened droid, he hears a voice from behind him. "Need some help, Eric?" Simon says, sitting up. "Wonder Man, awake?" "Awake and angry." While the Williams brothers are going at it, Vision knows what he has to do. "For a long time, I believed I was not human. Experiences with the Avengers, marriage to Wanda, and the revival of Simon Williams has disabused me of that notion. Thus, I must bear the pain if I am to save one who is both as inhuman and as human as I. Simon Williams is my brother." He reaches the one hand he still has through the Grim Reaper and protects Simon from the attacks from this other brother. On the last page, Wanda awakens from her chloroform-induced sleep. She pops her head through the destroyed wall, looking at the wreckage of the operating room. "Vision, my husband, my love!" "She comes to me, an angel in scarlet, and I know I am awake, for no dream could be so divine. Yes, it is good to be awake, good to be alive, good to love and be loved, as a man loves and is loved by his wife and his brother." The end. So as my internet buddy and podcasting colleague Trentus Magnus would ask, what did I think of this? First, I like the continuity. I'm getting over my expectation that this will be just one long story like modern miniseries often are. But what is happening here is, I don't know, sort of low-end continuity. The stories are happening in a particular order, with events from one leading into the next. So they're not standalones, technically speaking, especially here from issue 2 into issue 3. What is happening here, the events, the surgery, the hospital, that's a direct effect of the way the prior issue concluded. As some of the emailers pointed out, part of the pitch of this series was for Mantlo to pick up some long-standing plot threads and tease them out over the course of the series. And what I liked about this one in particular was that Mantlo gave himself a dramatic plot thread in issue 2, the destruction of Vision's arm, and used this issue, issue 3, as an opportunity to react to that plot thread, while also pulling in the Simon Williams angle, which pulls in the Grim Reaper. You can almost see the gears turning in Mantlo's mind as his plot goes from here to there to there, where, you know, step by step, it makes sense. And those characters, being related to each other by their pasts, led naturally to the theme of this issue, Vision's take on his relationship with his creators, and then with Simon in particular. The notion that these two characters, Wonder Man and Vision, are twins, in a manner of speaking. Again, I liked Mantlo pulling on that thread, and he ends up telling quite a compelling character piece, in addition to, you know, an action-packed fight issue. And as I tend to do anytime I cover a story written by Bill Mantlo, I have to point out that he's not just a master of story, but of the script as well. It's tempting to think of those as the same thing, but they aren't. Now, to be fair, this is Marvel, so I don't want to ignore Rick Leonardi's role in the plotting as well. Both the plotting, the big picture story that's being told, and the details, the script, the exact words in the caption boxes and speech bubbles. It's all quite good. I may have said this in the last episode, but I remember having read these 30-plus years ago and having positive recollections of reading these. And it's good to have those nostalgic feelings confirmed. We've all been in the position, the situation, where reading a 30-year-old story does not confirm those nostalgic feelings we had. Two very specific comments on particular story elements, one good and one, you know, not as good. We'll start with the obvious plot hole, and I read through this a second time to see if it was addressed, but I didn't see it. The entire Avengers are in the waiting room at the start, which is great. The support that they are showing, not current teammates, retired Avengers, that was a great element. But then they're gone from the story. They disappear, as, by the way, did every doctor on this floor, evidently, or maybe the entire hospital. But it's tricky, because having the Avengers there at the beginning was great, like I said, but then having them nowhere to be seen or heard from or referenced after those first few pages, it's a minor quibble, but I think it's a legitimate one. They also pulled the same trick of a doctor not knowing how to address a member of the superhero crowd. This time it's the surgeon, a different character from last episode, who stumbles through this. As I was saying, Ms. Scarlet Witch? Again, one funny moment in a pretty intense and emotional story. Well, it's time for a break, and when we come back, we'll wrap up this series with issue 4.
Hey there. Do you like Man-Thing? You know I do. In fact, there is nothing I like more than getting my hands on a giant-sized Man-Thing. It just makes me feel so good. Wait, you know I'm talking about the comic book character, right? Of course you do. How could you be thinking anything else? Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre. Oh, and I'll probably make some penis jokes.
And we're back. Again. Vision and Scarlet Witch number 4 had a cover price of 60 cents, meaning I acquired this book at a, still not great, but I'm getting used to it by this point, 58% discount. The cover, by Rick Leonardi, shows Magneto right in the center of the page, and he is leaping out at us. And he is not smiling. On either side of him, maybe cowering back or being pushed aside by the force of his flight, are our two title characters, along with Crystal and Quicksilver. The story, please allow me to introduce myself, is really hard to say without falling into a Mick Jagger impression. And it had the same creative team as the rest of the series, having been written by Bill Mantlow with art by Rick Leonardi, Ian Aiken, and Brian Garvey. We open on a mountain called Wundagore. A being we only know, at least for now, assuming we forget what we just saw on the cover, but we'll humor the book, is the White Pilgrim. The paths have been made treacherous by hours of swirling snow. The elements do not seem to trouble the White Pilgrim. He reaches the door of the house of a talking cow. Cool? I am Bova, the cow says. Midwife of Wundagore, a new woman evolved from a cow by the Lord High Evolutionary. Okay, that almost makes sense now. As the pair chat over cups of hot tea, Bova gets to reminiscing, and she tells the story of that one time she acted as midwife to a woman named Magda. At that, the pilgrim's eyes blaze beneath his cowl. Bova reveals that the women's children still live. The White Pilgrim suddenly becomes violent and presses her for the children's names, making her realize that he's the husband that Magda had fled. The stranger uses his power over the iron in her blood because he's Magneto. He forces her to reveal the children's names, which she does. Wanda and Pietro, of course! He then steps into the sky and is gone. Weakened, and with her cottage destroyed, all that Bova can do at this point is to beg the nearly comatose Madrid to cast a spell of warning to the children. And now, a third of the way through the issue, we meet our title characters. The next day, the Vision and Scarlet Witch head to Adelin on the blue side of the moon. The idea is to visit their infant niece and to have the Vision's arm restored by the Inhumans' advanced medical technology. Yeah, that didn't turn out so well last issue when they tried that at a regular human hospital. And the day after that, my arm, it is whole again. The Inhuman doctors say it was a simple operation and suggest that he test the new limb. He does, and it seems to work. My wife, I am well again. Wanda is so happy she could cry. As they hang out with Quicksilver, Crystal, and the newborn Luna, Wanda reveals that she had a troubling dream, complete with a voice saying, "Warn the children." Quicksilver had the same dream, which they both take to be a premonition of danger, but they discount it, given how safe they are in Adelin. Using his powers to control energies, the White Pilgrim arrives stealthily on the moon and then traps the family within Crystal's home. Quicksilver recognizes the voice. Though years have passed since I last heard it, never would I forget that voice. Casting his disguise aside, the visitor reveals himself to the Inhumans as the character we all know he is. Magneto, Master of Magnetism, I stand revealed. Quicksilver attacks quickly, protecting his family, but Magneto claims he has only come to talk. But the long history of distrust and deceit that he had sown with the former Brotherhood members and Avengers draws them into battle. Magneto initially holds back and tries to explain himself, but the combined assaults of Quicksilver, Scarlet Witch, Vision, and Crystal make him increasingly desperate and violent. It's only when Crystal calls a stop to the fighting, so it doesn't endanger her daughter, that he gets a chance to explain himself and the purpose of his visit. Magneto reveals that he is Wanda and Pietro's father, which sends shockwaves throughout the family. Magneto claims that he has recently reconsidered his stance against humanity, learning that he now has a human granddaughter, has made it clear for him that it's time to forget his hatred. Such enmities are ancient history. This child represents the new order of things. Now that his mutant son has sired a normal human child, he understands that he is now tied by blood to the human race. And on the last page of the issue and the series, Magneto holds baby Luna surrounded by family. If you really are our father, Wanda says, tears streaming from her eyes, what in heaven's name do we do now? The end. So what do I think of this one? Okay, obviously I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I finally figured out what Bill Mantlo was doing here. He wasn't telling one long plot story, but he was telling one long thematic story. What we have here, something that I'm sure you lovely listeners figured out way before I did. What we have is a four-issue limited series about family. That's the overarching story. That's the plot. That's what Mantlo was writing about. The first issue gives us Vision and Wanda moving into their new suburban home to begin their post-Avengers life as regular old married people. Then we have them dealing with the issues of Wanda's supposed, but not really actual father, the Wizard. And then we get a story featuring Vision's blood brother, Wonder Man, and the implications of that relationship. And then we get the entire family here visiting Wanda's brother and sister-in-law and their new baby. And that whole crew gets to deal with Wanda and Pietro meeting their actual real father, Magneto. Sometimes, in stories, comics, movies, whatever, the theme of family can just be thrown on top of a story just to put a theme of some kind in there, I think. It is one of the more common themes. But what I like about what Mantlo did here is that he took that common, ordinary theme and examined it a whole range of different ways. At least in terms of these stories, what we have here looking at this in early 1983, there is some reason to hope. This is a happy ending. Except that it involves Magneto, so that can't really last, can it? And of course it didn't. This scene, this ending scene, is actually revisited about 6 months later when it is a flashback in Avengers 234. That one was written by Roger Stern, and we see what happened in the moments after Mantlo's hopeful happy ending. It's revealed in the Avengers issue that in the moment immediately following the ending of this story, the twins utterly reject Magneto's olive branch and disown him as their father. So, this last splash, this sign of hope, it didn't last long. In that Stern story, Magneto does leave peacefully, but he promises that they will regret the decision eventually. Of course, he was a significant villain at the time, but in the decades that followed, he has become a legitimate top-tier villain, a status that the X-Men films have only reinforced. So what I'm saying is this, is that as nice and hopeful as the happy ending was, in terms of a limited series, the greater Marvel Universe, both in comics and beyond comics, needed Magneto as an antagonist. But that doesn't negate the final beat of this story. It actually makes it a little more poignant, maybe. I mean, this is really good stuff. I've not mentioned the art in these issues yet, and I definitely should. Between Leonardi's pencils and Aiken and Garvey's inks, the stories have a nice flow. The action pieces are clear and energetic. I do want to mention those last few pages in particular, where the details of facial expressions are especially strong. This, I assume, would be Aiken and Garvey. On that last page, Wanda is crying, and that looks great. It looks real. But it's the page before, where she is on the verge of tears. That may be the best, or at least the most subtle, art in the issue. She's not crying yet. But you can tell, you have the sense that she's about to. There's a lot going on in her face. And it's captured and portrayed very effectively. The verdict on Vision and Scarlet Witch number 3 and 4. I know I have a crush on Wanda, and so I have trouble being objective regarding the quality of comics that she appears in, but I enjoyed these issues. Now that I'm on board with what Mantlo was doing all along, instead of being deceived by my own expectations, I'm very impressed. These were fun reads, and they certainly weren't light reads. I imagine that the theme of family may give these books a chance at hitting that sort of timeless type of feel. That may be why they work for me. You know, revisiting issues like this every 10 years or so when we readers are in different stages of family life, where different aspects of those family stories may hit us differently. And that's a nice trick if you can pull it off. And I think that Mantlo and the team really managed to pull that off. Definite quarter bin deals. By the way, in addition to these four issues of Vision and Scarlet Witch, I actually have found in quarter bins 11 issues from the 12-issue limited series featuring them from just a few years later. Now, I think 12 issues may be a bit too long of a series to cover here on the podcast. That might be too many episodes dedicated to one series. But I do think that if I find that missing one, and off the top of my head I can't remember, it might be 5, it might be 6, I will read them and talk about them over on the Comics Reading Journal. That wraps up my coverage of the final two issues of Vision and Scarlet Witch, issues 3 and 4, bringing episode 82 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 83, we'll be observing the season of Halloween times by looking at The Phantom Stranger, number 21 from DC Comics, cover dated September-October 1972. And I won't be alone. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the series, the episode, or the podcast, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the quarter bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
Professor!